Providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the program, we'll be spending some time talking about United Nations peacekeeping. Today, United Nations peacekeepers are deployed in 17 nations around the world. And in recent years, or at least in recent decades, the number of these operations has grown. Another indicator of just how serious some of these conflicts are is the fact that also the numbers of peacekeepers who have been killed in the line of duty has also grown. At the same time, there has been criticism of the United Nations for failing to intervene in places around the world, for example, in Sudan. And it has been argued that somehow the United Nations needs to have a better structure so that it would be possible to respond more quickly, to intervene more quickly to prevent conflict. In this part of the show, that's what we'll talk a little bit about peacekeeping, about how it works, and also this idea of the need for a kind of a more rapid response from the United Nations. And our guest with the program is Paul Diehl. He is Henning Larsen Professor of Political Science and University Distinguished Teacher Scholar here at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. He also serves as Director of the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences Teaching Academy and Director of the Correlates of War Project, which is the largest data collection effort on international conflict. He's authored a number of books, just to mention a couple of recent ones. The most recent, entitled The Scourge of War, published by University of Michigan Press in 2004, and before that, a book entitled War and Peace and International Rivalry, published by University of Michigan Press in 2000. He's particularly interested in the causes of war, in peacekeeping, and international law. And perhaps in the interest of full disclosure, we should say he is also related to one of our producers, Martha Diehl. Glad to have him here on the program. And, of course, questions are welcome from people who are listening. We always invite them. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 locally here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free. 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And certainly people are welcome to call in, ask questions, make comments. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Glad to.
I appreciate it. Maybe we could talk a little bit generally about peacekeeping to start. As I mentioned, now there are peacekeepers, UN peacekeepers, and I think the correct number is 17. Something like that, 17 mm-hmm. places around the world. Some of these peacekeeping operations have been going on for decades. For
almost 60 years
for
in a few
quite
cases.
A long time. And most of the, I think if I remember the map, most of them, the greatest single number on any continent are in Africa. But they're mm-hmm. also in Europe. They're in the Middle East. I think that there are still some. Are there still some in Indonesia?
No, not in Indonesia, but there's a small observer force stationed along the ceasefire lines between India and Pakistan.
Yeah, okay. How does the United Nations decide where peacekeepers will be deployed?
Okay. I think the best way to understand it is compare it to a fire call. If your house is burning or your neighbor's house are burning, there's a call that goes into the local fire station. Immediately, the fire personnel scramble, get on the engines, call out, call the police, and immediately go to wherever the fire is. And so in some sense, you're looking at a process that the infrastructure is already there. There's a firehouse, there's firemen waiting, and the response is immediate. Other than having the kind of the call go into the UN, I think the analogy breaks down after that, but it's a nice contrast. Mm-hmm. When there's a crisis out in the world, the UN responds first by having the matter brought to its attention to the Security Council, and that can be done by any of the member states or by the Secretary General. But well, you know, once that's brought to the Security Council, that doesn't mean the fire personnel immediately go to the area, and hence the need for rapid deployment force. What happens then is that the Security Council then debates what kind of response that could happen that ranges from anything from doing nothing to, passing resolutions to sending some type of military force. Mm-hmm. That can be a long process because you have to get the 15 members to agree to take some type of action. you know, presuming that they're willing to take some kind of action and they actually have, you know, agree to authorize a peacekeeping force, which usually can take a couple months. Once that decision's made, once again, fire personnel don't immediately go to the conflict. What happens is that the UN Secretary General and his staff appoint a team to work on that particular peacekeeping operation. At that point, they solicit contributions in the forms of troops, supplies, logistics, etc., from member states, and they appoint a commander who's often a senior military officer from one of the member states to organize and run the operation. Some have made the other kind of analogy that this is the equivalent of once the peacekeeping force is authorized, you pass the hat and see who's willing to make contributions. And once that is all put together, it's clear who's going to contribute what, who's going to command it, then the peacekeeping force is deployed. At best, some personnel may be on the ground within a week of authorization, because sometimes, you know, we can anticipate that it's going to be authorized. But in other cases, you may not find a peacekeeping force fully operational until several months after the time that it's been authorized. Or even if you look at a situation in the Congo, which went through this long process, and they had the troops ready and they were ready to go, the member states of the UN said that the forces would not be deployed until there was some type of peace agreement and the fighting died down. So even then, when they were ready to go and you solved all the logistical problems, it was another 6 months to a year before they actually hit the ground.
Yeah. And I think that this points to many problems. I guess one of them, just the last one you touched on, is some people would argue that peacekeeping can't really succeed unless the parties that are involved in the conflict are interested in there being some peace. Mm-hmm. So, and the idea is not the UN force. It's not like an army, not really. So the question is, well, is it really set up well enough to defend itself? Is the idea that it should actually be in there going in and being involved in conflict? Is it actually the fact that the UN peacekeepers are physically supposed to be in there and saying to the parties in the conflict, okay, break it up? Or is the idea that that in fact hostilities have to have ceased or be close to ceasing, and the parties in the conflict have to agree, and then the peacekeepers can come in? And indeed, the idea is keeping peace, in a sense, not making peace.
Right. I think the traditional notion of peacekeeping is that it is not a force. It is not a force designed to impose peace on an area. Mm-hmm. All one has to do is look at the numbers and the way that they're armed. The average peacekeeping force size has grown, but it's still only about 10,000 troops at most, and typically it may be 4,000 or 5,000. And the average peacekeeping soldier is armed with a rifle and has rules of engagement such that they can only fire in self-defense. You know, and when you look at that kind of relatively small force, you know, compare 6,000 to 150,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, and compare the arms that they carry, a rifle, which is much less armed than the average Chicago or L.A. street gang member, they're really not designed to do that. The problem comes in is there are certain conflicts in the world where you don't necessarily have the cooperation of all the parties involved who don't necessarily want peace. And the unfortunate choice then you may face is that if you wait until a peace agreement takes place and all sides agree, large number of people have died by the time you've done that. And hence, some UN peacekeeping has evolved over time that there's the belief that you may need, under some circumstances, particularly in the case of genocide, you need to move international troops in there earlier. There need to be larger numbers, and they need to have different rules of engagement.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is the central issue.
Yeah.
What sort of support is there for such a force being constructed? So obviously you would need to have greater resources. You'd need to think differently about how you deploy them. You might have to provide them with different sorts of rules under which to operate. How exactly do you even start thinking about such a thing?
Well, I mean, you know, the idea of the UN having some type of rapid deployment force is not a new one. Mm-hmm. If you look back into the UN Charter 1945, there are provisions for the UN having military forces contributed by member states, but none of those agreements were ever negotiated. In 1948, you had UN Secretary General Trigby Lee come up with the idea of a UN guard that would perform some of these kind of functions and to send out some type of that. And at various times over the last 60-some years, proposals have come up about having some type of UN permanent force, particularly a rapid deployment force, would be deployed at the beginning of a crisis or with an imminent threat of genocide. I would say in the last 10 years, that idea has taken off more, particularly in the aftermath of Rwanda, where a number of states, particularly the government of the Netherlands, Canada, and a number of study groups have put together proposals for a rapid deployment force. I think some of the ideas are gaining more public support as well as international support. But, you know, 10 years later, we still don't have a force. And what you have at best now is a scattering of different kinds of standby arrangements and other preliminary arrangements, but they're still a big step away from having soldiers ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is, I guess then that gets to the question, given the fact that this is something that's been discussed for a long time and that it would be difficult to organize it and difficult to structure it and difficult to decide how it is you're going to decide how you're going to deploy all of that. Do you think that there isn't really, in fact, much chance that such a thing would ever exist?
Not in its the present form of the proposals. I mean, you have to look at when you hear the things that the idea that the UN should have a rapid deployment force, there's really a wide variety of proposals that are lumped under that category. Mm-hmm. There's what you might call the used car Yugo version, which is the ultimate stripped down version of this kind of proposal, under which you would have standby troops that stay in their home countries, ready for deployment if authorized at some time, and some of the paperwork and arrangements have been made, and these often may number a few thousand. There's what you might call the Cadillac version of these kind of proposals, which involve, you know, maybe 15,000 troops that would be integrated under one central UN command that would be trained together. You'd have the supplies already in several different parts of the world, and you'd have a full UN bureaucracy that goes along with that. I think the Cadillac version is highly unrealistic at that point. I don't believe that member states are willing to give the UN the authority to put that together. Even though the costs are not necessarily that great, member states have been reluctant to spend roughly the $1 billion or so, what the estimates say would cost a year. Now, if you go back to the stripped-down version of this type of proposal of having merely standby arrangements and others, we've moved in that kind of direction already in several ways. First, the UN has a standby arrangement system where it's negotiated agreements with 80-some countries on the potential for having a peacekeeping deployment. In effect, what they've done is they've taken care of all the paperwork and arrangements on what supplies and troops might be available, under what conditions might be deployed, where are they located now. So in a sense that when it's authorized, one doesn't have to go through much in the negotiations and the paperwork involved in giving troops over to UN command. You also have several states in the Nordic area, Canada and elsewhere, who have made some standby arrangements and have troops designated or earmarked for peacekeeping duty. And the UN has also upgraded in the last 10 years its planning mechanisms in anticipating peacekeeping operations so that they set some supplies aside that before peacekeeping forces authorize, they do some of the advanced planning and estimate what's needed. So we're creeping toward having a very limited version of this rapid deployment force. But what we don't have, and what I don't think is likely anytime soon, is a full-fledged, ready-to-go force that trains and is integrated together.
Yeah. I guess that I would expect that the major problem, no matter what kind of force it is, would be in getting the most powerful interests in the United Nations to agree on whether or not it would be deployed and where. And I am assuming that at the very least it would be something that would require the approval of the nations that are members of the Security Council,
right,
to do that. And given the fact that all those nations do have different interests, if you said everybody has to agree, that it seems to me that that's an essential problem up until now. That's why it has taken so long to make the decisions of deployments that have been made, is that you got to get everybody on board, and everybody might not see that you know, there, or they might see that they have competing interests, and to get Russia and China and France and the United States and Britain and whoever else, everybody to agree. It sounds like it should be a pretty tough thing.
Yeah, and I think in part that's what people forget about some of the debate over rapid deployment force of the UN, is even if we had the equivalent of many fire stations around the world with personnel ready to go, they have to be authorized to do something. And virtually most every proposal still requires that the Security Council authorize that. So even if we get beyond all the difficulties of having troops, paying for them, getting them ready, you still have to decide to send them. And I think the Sudan case is illustrative of that. Let's assume that we had a UN kind of force available. There are 15 or 20,000 troops ready for deployment. Security Council still has to decide that. Well, you know, when would they decide that? The first, they have to look at a crisis and say it's serious enough that we need to get troops on the ground as soon as possible. Well, fighting in Darfur and some of the acts have been going on for 3 years now. So, you know, even if we didn't have advance warning of some of the genocide or whatever you want to call it that's taking place in Darfur, at least now we've had 3 years worth of that. It's been almost 2 years since Secretary of State Colin Powell labeled it genocide. A top UN official referred to it as the renewal of the killing fields, making the analogy to Cambodia. It's been now a year since the UN actually itself sent a inquiry team to investigate there. And while they didn't call it genocide, they did make a list of a whole series of international crimes that were taking place there. So we have had a case here where there's been a clear significant loss of life, various human rights violations, probably even genocide, and yet we still haven't had the international community, with the exception of African Union peacekeepers, take any type of action. Mm-hmm. And generally, with respect to Sudan, Russia has been reluctant to sending any kind of international force in there. China has strongly opposed it, and many of the surrounding African states have opposed it. So, you know, it's fine to have fire stations and things like that, but if they're not authorized to go out and fight those fires in Sudan or other parts of Africa, they'll just sit there.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Paul Deal. He's professor of political science at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about an area that is of particular interest then, that is UN peacekeeping, international law, causes of war. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Is there what does international law say about the sovereignty issues involved here? And if there's a country where there's a conflict going on, and supposing that you could even get everybody to agree to send a force in, if the government of that country says essentially, well, it's none of your business, this is our country, you know, go away, what does the law say?
Well, traditional international law had said that whatever happens when the inside of the country was within the purview of that particular country, and there were few, if any, kinds of cases or exceptions to that. I see international law as evolving, though, to recognize that there are certain threats to international peace and security that involve civil wars and conflicts that take part within there. And I think there's evolving norms of international humanitarian law that suggest that the international community has a right to intervene under some certain kind of circumstances. But in large part, formal international law, treaties, and the like have been lagging behind the change in those kinds of norms. So if you look in the UN Charter and most of the rules on when you can use military force, most of those were designed to deal with wars and conflicts between states and some type of traditional warfare. And they don't reflect very well the kind of rules and things that you need for certain kinds of civil wars or even terrorism. One also has to look, if you want, to the UN Convention on Genocide, which defines genocide. But for the most part, it doesn't provide any type of mechanism that that allows the international community, much less requires them to take any kind of action to prevent genocide. I believe the exact title of the treaty is the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide, but if you actually read it, it focuses much more on the punishment kind of aspect than it does on mechanisms to do that. And the provisions that exist in there is that is that aggrieved parties can appeal to the United Nations. But again, there is no strong, clear kind of provisions that talk about when you can intervene or why you or how you should intervene or any international obligation to do so. We may be moving for that, but the formal international law on that, I think, is still underdeveloped.
Mm-hmm. Just going back to the case study of Darfur, you're talking about the fact that while there is widespread acknowledgement that there is a problem and that perhaps the United Nations should do something about it, but that there's reluctance on some countries to sanction sending of troops in there, particularly in China and Russia, I'm guessing that that's because the Chinese and the Russians don't want someone coming along and questioning their own policies in places like Tibet and Chechnya.
Yeah, right.
So they're saying, you know, they don't want to sanction that happening someplace else because they see that then somebody's going to call them on and say, well, what's going on right here in your own countries? And they certainly wouldn't be interested in international pressure coming to bear on them on their own policies. It seems like that's something that you're never really going to be able to get around.
Right. Well, again, Sudan is a great case study because there are a number of different things going on there. You know, in China's case, they have the sovereignty issue, and it's been the Chinese position that UN international organizations have no right to interfere with those kind of sovereign things. So they're concerned about Tibet and many of the other ethnic problems they have there. Depending on how much weight you want to give it, China also gets a significant portion of its oil from Sudan and has close ties to the Sudanese government. Russia has its own interest in Chechnya and the sovereignty issue. The U.S. has been out front in declaring this as genocide, but it has its own issues with sending its troops to Afghanistan and Iraq and doesn't seem to, you know, be willing to put together a force that would be sent there, you know, as well as, you know, pretty much willing to defer to the African Union to do things. And then complicating that factor is in another part of Sudan, you've just had a civil war settlement between the north and the south, where, strange enough, the UN is going to send 10,000 peacekeeping troops there to monitor that ceasefire settlement. And at that point, you need the cooperation of the north, which is the Sudanese government there. So to some extent, by taking action in Darfur and criticizing that, you know, that government and others may undermine the cooperation you need from them to implement the peace agreement to the civil war in the other part of the country. So, I mean, there's a number of competing interests, and the killing that's happening in the Darfur region is taking a second stage to a series of other kinds of interests and concerns.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about earlier the sort of metaphor you've got a fire and you know that the fire is going on, and so it takes a while to acknowledge that's going on, to decide we're going to have a response, and then it's as if you have to go out and recruit volunteer firemen.
Right.
You have to go around the world to different nations saying, would you mind contributing some troops to this effort? Who does it? Where do most of the peacekeepers come from, and why would a nation be interested in doing that, supplying their soldiers to a UN peacekeeping mission?
Well, I mean, traditionally, peacekeepers come from states who do not have a direct interest or are not geographically proximate to where the conflict's taking place, although that's not always the case. And there's a number of states. The United States has contributed peacekeepers in the post-Cold War era to numbers, and there's a wide variety of countries who do that. And that runs everything from Fiji, which is a prominent contributor to a number of operations, to India and Pakistan, as well as others. Why would they do it? I think there's a number of things. Some countries feel a strong altruistic connection to UN peacekeeping operations. So historically, Canada was strongly involved in the creation of the peacekeeping forces in the 1950s and has always felt that that's part of their military mission, so that they feel that that's a strong component. And that's the same thing true of countries such as Norway and Sweden. Other smaller countries may share some of those altruistic reasons, but they may also more pecuniary reasons for taking part. For countries such as Fiji, Pakistan, and some of the African countries, participating in peacekeeping operations is more than just gaining international prestige and doing your part. They also receive training and deployment for their troops that they wouldn't normally receive. And, you know, it's better training, better deployment, better experience than they would get in normal operations. And the United Nations does pay through its members money back to host the countries who provide troops. And typically what happens is that soldiers, let's say, from Fiji or an African state will receive their normal pay, which is relatively low for serving in peacekeeping operations. But the country will receive money that's much higher than what they pay their own soldiers. So in a sense, they can pocket, if you will, a profit from participating in this. And, you know, and from that vantage point, peacekeeping operations, for the most part, are not that dangerous of missions. You know, the death rates are, you know, far, far smaller than you'd see in, like, an operation such as Iraq. And so from their vantage point, you get the international prestige of participating. You actually may make some money as part of the process, and you may get some supplies and training for your troops that you wouldn't otherwise do it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with the caller here, someone in Urbana with question, comment, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Would you comment on the three significant failings of the United Nations? One, the impotence in Iraq to force Hussein from power. That's number one. Two, the oil for food program, a multi-billion-dollar fraud that Kofi Annan, as CEO, should have known. And the Human Rights Commission is the third point. Aren't some dictators on there? Isn't Zimbabwe or China on the Human Rights Commission? So there's three of them, impotence in Iraq and oil for food and the HRC, Human Rights Commission.
Okay, well, let's probably agree with you on two of those three as failures, but not all three of them. The first is the idea of forcing Hussein from power. That was never the role of the United Nations. And what role the United Nations to do in Iraq was first was authorizing weapons inspectors to determine that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
They could have imposed sanctions, though.
There were, and that comes to the oil to food program. But in some sense, their job was not to remove Saddam Hussein anymore. It's a job to, you know, remove the dictator in North Korea, Iran, or anybody else. And, you know, in some sense, what the UN did there, you know, in terms of the International Atomic Energy Agency and others, I think in retrospect looks pretty good. The other part that the UN did was authorize the protection of the Kurds and other civilian populations from no-fly zones, authorizing the U.S. and Great Britain to carry out that particular mission. And generally, I would consider that a particular success. Now, the other two cases are hardly shining moments for the United Nations. The oil for food program is, I think, a clear case of a failure there. I think it underlines problems with sanctions in general of how when you impose sanctions on a country, the people, those who often suffer are not the leadership that it's targeted for, but the civilians involved. But it's clear that there was widespread corruption there that we perhaps haven't even seen the full tip of. And the third thing that you point out is the Human Rights Commission. It's an organization that is in charge of monitoring and sanctioning those who commit human rights violations. The clear problem has been the membership with it. You're quite correct that many of those who are members and seek to be members are those who are among the most egregious human rights violators. And not surprisingly, that is a group that has been reluctant to take action. It's a case where you see the votes that they do hold tend to be of the, you know, 25 to 23 positive or negative on whether to condemn human rights violations in Cuba or elsewhere. In the UN's defense, a number of the proposals suggested look for reform of that body. And Kofi Annan's plans for UN reform include a proposal to completely scrap that Human Rights Commission and replace it with a new body that would include a different membership, require essentially a pretty much of an overwhelming vote before a state would be allowed to serve on that body, which would pretty much preclude some of the worst human rights violators to take place. It's largely a body that has a normative power and does not have a power, in a sense, to pass economic sanctions or to, you know, redress wrongdoings directly anyway. But it does have an important sense of legitimacy. But it's clear, if you wanted to list clear UN failures, one would say that the Oil for Food Program, the Human Rights Commission, you know, were clearly at the top of the list. But one also doesn't forget then that when you evaluate the UN, there is a series of other there's a series of accomplishments on the other side of the ledger, and that's UN programs that deal with refugees, disease prevention, and the like. And I think it's always important to keep a balance for understanding what we can expect the UN to do well and what we might not expect it to do well.
Well, if I could make one other comment, mm-hmm. I believe the the war in Iraq was wrong because there were too many civilian casualties caused by the incursion, the invasion of soldiers. Of course, the big question is now, what do we do? But that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Right, and if you think how things might have been different had the UN been involved earlier in the process, sort of post-U.S. invasion, I think there are both grounds for optimism and pessimism. It's clear that the UN and perhaps with significant involvement by some of the Arab states might have had greater legitimacy in carrying out some of the functions, et cetera. But it's probably equally clear that a standard UN peacekeeping force would be no more successful and probably significantly less successful in establishing order in key cities as well. So,
for those people who are strong critics of the United Nations generally and of Kofi Annan and his leadership specifically, the scandal in the oil for food program has been one of those things, one of those big sticks that they use to attack the organization. Is there evidence to show that that Kofi Annan is in any way, in any direct sort of way, responsible for or tainted by that scandal?
Well, I'm not sure it's entirely clear. The commission that's investigating it is still investigating that. Mm-hmm. It's clear that his son received some contracts involved. So, to what extent that he knew about what was going on is not clear. Probably a better question is, should he have known some of the other things that have been taking place? But Kofi Annan has shown a unbelievable ability to shed types of criticism over time. Most people don't know, but that during the Rwandan genocide, Kofi Annan was not UN Secretary General, but he was Under Secretary General in charge of peacekeeping operations, and perhaps the single person responsible for not heeding the calls of reinforcing UN peacekeeping troops as requested by the commander or sending additional troops for that there. One would say, arguably, that scandal, I would say, is far worse. The death of 800,000 people is far worse than, a few million or billion dollar payoffs to some cronies. And yet he weathered that storm, and he seems to perhaps have weathered that. His term is up at the end of the year, and it'll be interesting to see whether he gets reappointed or not. But he's maintained great relationships with the United States and other key members of the UN, and he has strong support within the UN bureaucracy. So, in the grand scheme of things, it may not matter.
Let's talk with someone in Champaign County. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I had a topic that was more germane, but since you're talking about this other stuff has been brought up, I think it's impotence, not impudence, that the previous caller was referring to. And I think Kofi Annan was hands were tied about Rwanda because of largely a great power role, the U.S. particularly. There was almost a deal cut to send in some reinforced Guyanese troops and with some U.S. involvement, and that was on Clinton's watch, and he's claimed that he regrets it. But I think Galloway's critique of the oil for food thing is perfectly right. The U.S. knew a lot about what the worst offenses of diverting oil and kickbacks were. They knew what was going on. So, and I think it was a smokescreen for the larcenous activities that were going on at the time of the inquiry, when they should have been looking into what the U.S. role of all of the billions of dollars that went down some hole or another in Iraq at the time. So that needs a lot of scrutiny. But I was going to call. I wanted to call about one of the first things that happened in the. I think it was the first year of the Bush administration's that this War College in Carlton, Pennsylvania, was phasing out its peacekeeping institute or something like that, and there was the U.S. was going to not even pretend to be studying any need for that kind of discourse or any kind of discipline in that way in the War College, and there was it was reversed, but it actually has been extended, but it's not really. peacekeeping, in my opinion. I don't know. Maybe you have an opinion on that. But what's going on contemporaneously seems like is that the Pentagon is actually getting into quote-unquote nation-building and social activities. So all through Latin America, there's a new report out called Erasing the Lines from the Latin American Working Group that shows how the Pentagon is going to be taking over activities that are normally done by the State Department. It's exactly the kind of nation-building and social activity that, you know, you would expect would probably go along with a peacekeeping activity. There's a lot of contradictions in that as well, so I don't know how you'd like to respond.
Well, there's a lot there. Let me just focus on the U.S. role in the peacekeeping that you mentioned toward the end. When I visited Fort Leavenworth for the National Academy of Sciences 10 years ago, we looked at their training programs for peacekeepers. And at that time, for a series of majors and colonels, approximately a class of 500 senior military officers, at that time they had one course on peacekeeping. It was an elective, and it had room for 20 officers, and it was taught by a Canadian officer. And the message that at that time in the U.S. military and planning for peacekeeping missions clearly was that if you valued your career and your advancement, you probably weren't going to concentrate on peacekeeping operations. I think they've made great strides in the last 10 years, but there's still, I think, a reluctance within the U.S. military structure to play these kind of roles. It's not what they think they should be doing. You know, their roles, they see, are traditional warfighting ones and not peacekeeping. And, well, I think some of those things are changing generationally as you get officers who played a role in those kind of missions, and it becomes more important. Some of that's changing, but there's still that kind of reluctance is this is not what we should be doing, and this is in some ways kind of illegitimate kinds of actions. But I think basically the U.S. military and others do what they're told, and that's what the kinds of priorities and things that the Bush administration and others have now involve increasingly things called nation building or peacekeeping in places like Iraq or Afghanistan, and whether the military likes it or not, it's doing that. And it has adjusted its much of its military training so that it moves away from just pure combat skills to more interpersonal skills. So that means training some of its military officers to do negotiation, to work with local forces, things like that, that they would not receive as part of a standard kind of training. But I don't think that the military has made that kind of, you know, fully made that kind of transition. But it's also not clear that the administration is going to be fully committed to the kinds of peace building or nation building operations that the UN and other organizations carry out.
Well, I mean, winning hearts and minds was a slogan in the Vietnam era, and it wasn't done very well, obviously. One wonders whether it's authentically committed, but I don't know. You gave sort of an idea of how much commitment there was in those days. Do you have any statistical way of suggesting that it's gotten to be that much more appreciated and committed to? And I would just wonder whether some of that might be related to the fact that along the lines of this critique that was done by this Latin American Working Group as well as this Center for International Policy, a former ambassador from El Salvador being the point person on that group, whether that's where the support for this kind of activity is coming from. It's not so much a commitment for peacekeeping, but a commitment for, you know, implementing U.S. policy, but using non-traditional means that, as you say, a lot of the military don't appreciate.
Well, I think the U.S. commitment involved in this is more on an ad hoc basis, depending on where it is and what their involvement is, rather than a becoming kind of a broad new strategy for U.S. policy in the U.S. military. The U.N. is just now committed to a new peace-building commission that will include a lot more planning, working with non-governmental organizations like the IMF and the World Bank, to carry out aid packages and things like that. To me, that's at least the first steps of a commitment to having an integrated strategy to do that. The U.S., to me, in my view, hasn't necessarily signed on to that as part of its own foreign policy yet.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. We have some others I want to get in. We have about 15 minutes left. Our guest is Paul Deal. He's professor of political science here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He's interested particularly in UN peacekeeping, international law, the causes of war. Questions are welcome. We are talking about UN peacekeeping, how it's designed to work, some of the problems, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. How are you? Mm-hmm. A very interesting subject. I know you're speaking of the present tense and the topicality of all these subjects, but I've always wondered, prior to something like the UN, what's the history of countries, you know, other than countries bordering countries, like, you know, in Europe or something? When did people sort of get this international idea that, you know, halfway across the world is our problem? Or someone else's problem, or the British's problem back in the 19th century and things like that. Is there any literature on that, like someone has written a book of the history of the idea of this, where you intercede in a country's internal politics or social structures and help them? I mean, I know famines and stuff like that, but do you know of any literature on that?
You know, I'm scrambling for individual names and things that go along with books. There are several books that have come out in the last 10 or 20 years that talk about changing notions of sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And many of those, one that comes to mind is an edited collection by Gene Lyons and Michael Mastinuto, mm-hmm. That talk about how the traditional Westphalian system conception of sovereignty, which means that states have a hard shell mm-hmm. around their borders and anything that happens in there is their own purview, has changed and continues to evolve over time. I think most of the notions of that tend to be traced more to the beginnings of the 20th century. Yeah. And many would say that acts of genocide during the Holocaust and significant human rights violations start to open up the idea that the international community has an interest in what goes on beyond that. So I would trace that evolution of the changing notions of sovereignty along with notions of what human rights. Because once you recognize that there are such things as international human rights that exist, and therefore who's the most likely violator, states, and the international community has an interest in that, it's a next step to then start to recognize that what goes on within an individual country has their particular interest. Others have cited, issues such as globalization and economic interests and things like that. Many of those kinds of interests in other state and trade and colonialism existed for many years after that. So, in many cases, it's still it's a recent phenomenon, but it's by no means a complete evolution yet. There are still many countries in the world, China and elsewhere, who do not necessarily recognize a broader idea that the international community has those kinds of interests. So I would still say it's very much in flux.
Yeah, that's what I sort of would have agreed with. But it's interesting that it's really not that old. So in a sense, all these teething pains, you might say, of how everybody sort of comes on board after, let's say, another 100 years. So that's what I was curious about. But thanks a lot. Okay. It's a real interesting subject.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Let's go to another caller. They are listening in Chicago this morning, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I think it's important to remember that, you know, as far as the oil for food, the food part was pretty successful because since the UN, the United States has taken over, malnutrition, among children has more than doubled in Iraq. And I think it's sometimes when we look at the corruption, we don't check and see did it at least achieve something for the poor people in this situation. And I don't think we should forget that because obviously big bucks and corruption seem to go together because now we have the scandal with the oil ministry and that $9 billion disappearing under the United States watch. So let's not forget that at least in the food portion of that program, it had some success. And the other comment, I'm not exactly sure when the UN peacekeepers could have come in. You talked about a post-invasion moment, but there really wasn't. In April, you had the problem in Fallujah where the American soldiers killed 19 civilians, and pretty much the problems, the insurgency developed from that. So I don't see that window when they could have been brought in. And then finally, my question is, it seems like peacekeepers, and I don't know if you discussed this earlier, peacekeepers are not peacekeepers. They're simply the military. And when you look at the acts of the military in Katrina, because they're in New Orleans, they were basically supposedly a peacekeeping force, but they were pointing guns at civilians and at children. So is the real problem with peacekeeping that we don't have peacekeepers? We're simply using the military in another role, and it's just not very easy to shift?
Okay. I'll leave aside the issues on the food program, since I've heard various estimates depending on one's political ideology on whether the oil for food program medicine was getting through or not during the sanctions. But let's go first to the post-invasion. There was a moment after the Hussein government fell in Iraq where the U.S. was starting to work on post-conflict peace building and moving it toward democratization. And that seemed like a logical role in a moment of opportunity where the UN could have been brought in to help distribute humanitarian aid. The UN has an electoral assistance unit that helps set up election machinery, et cetera. And they've contributed in part on that. And it has its available a series of other staff that could have been brought in and carried out some of the functions there. The main issue was is the U.S. didn't want that particular assistance at that time, even though it was offered. Kind of more interesting, I think, is the last point that you've raised, and that's that, you know, these aren't peacekeepers, they're military. In military parlance, they refer to a series of these operations as MUTA, which is military operations other than war. And these range from supervising elections, you know, protecting refugees, and delivering assistance to disaster victims. I think part of the problem isn't so much that that they're military, is that for the most part is for many of these other MUTA missions is they don't necessarily receive the training that goes into that. I mean, it's quite different if you're a military officer where you have to take your men and seize a particular area in a traditional military mission rather than one that's supposed to capture snipers, provide humanitarian aid, or in some cases, keep law and order in the streets of New Orleans. So, you know, in my own opinion, I would say that in many cases, we've asked the military to do more than they've been trained for or appropriate to do. And if we are going to ask them to do that, we need to designate certain units to carry those out and train them properly.
I want to thank again the caller for her comments. We're very short on time. I have one more caller I'd like to try to get in. Someone listening in this morning in Indianapolis. So we will go there. And this is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
How are you doing?
Good.
This actually does just follow up with that last question perfectly. I am a military officer. I'm in the Army. And the actual training devoted to what, I mean, they call it stability and support operations as well as what they're terming it now other than MUTA. And the amount of training put into that is absolutely minimal, and it's still, and this is training I received in 2005. And the amount of training given to that, given our current operations in Iraq, is still stunning in my mind, given that what exactly our mission is and what we've been doing there. And I'm wondering if you found, what I found with the U.S. military is that they excel at traditional combat operations but are still lacking because they lack the training in peacekeeping operations. Whereas UN peacekeeping traditionally has absolutely excelled at peacekeeping operations, but when it comes time to traditional military operations, they've found themselves lacking. Cases like Srebrenica or Rwanda itself, there seems to be a divide that between the U.S., where the U.S. priorities and the UN priorities are at. And I'm wondering if there's not a middle ground that both sides could move towards, with the UN improving its military operations and the U.S. improving its peacekeeping operations.
Well, I mean, I think it's easier to do the latter than the former. You know, if the U.S. wants to improve its peacekeeping performance, it's going to have to devote time for training. But most military officers that I've talked to, you know, just say, look, we don't have the time to carry out some of these kind of training exercises. And you raise the other kind of issue of whether the kind of training you have for a peacekeeping operation is compatible with the kind of training you have for traditional military operations, and can, you know, your typical soldier just flip a switch to change their orientation, their role, and their attitudes immediately? You know,
right.
having the UN, improve its peacekeeping operations, I think is more difficult simply because the UN doesn't have soldiers. The only soldiers it gets is the ones that are provided to by its member states. And those soldiers remain in national units under a loose international kind of command structure. So while the UN sponsors seminars, it sends out experts, it helps in some of the training with that. Fundamentally, how well you know, those serving in UN missions, be they those with traditional peacekeeping or those that are more coercive, still fundamentally depend on the kind of training, the willingness and the command of a national unit. So, and there's only so much, I think, that the United Nations can do to try and deal with that.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We are just about the point where we're going to have to finish. There's a sort of final point maybe you want to make?
Okay. I mean, I think that when one looks at kind of what the UN can do, I think there's a tendency in some cases on one part of the political spectrum to blame everything on member states and to say, well, it's because the U.S., China, or others won't let the UN do what it does. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, the other side, often on the different end of the political spectrum, that tends to blame the organization. That says, you know, the UN's incompetent and points to things like the oil for food scandal and other kinds of things. And I think in many cases, the reality is probably somewhere in between, is in some sense what the UN can do and what kind of missions it can carry out is largely just a function of what its members allow it to do. Remember, to send out a peacekeeping operation has to be authorized that way. You know, but there are other elements that the UN can strengthen itself. The UN is a bureaucracy like any other bureaucracy, and it has its corruptions, it has its inefficiencies. And I think there's, you know, there's a number of things that it also can do to improve its performance. And I think the most realistic way of looking at its performance and then envisioning what can be done in the future is understanding the kind of constraints that operate, both those imposed by the leading member states as well as those imposed by the fact that it's a huge international bureaucracy that has to serve a lot of different interests.
Right. Well, at that, we will leave it with our thanks to our guest, Paul Diehl. He's professor of political science here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champain. Thank you very much. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Infant Parent Institute, with offices in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. It is often said that America is a country that is interested only in today and tomorrow, and that yesterday is, well, yesterday. However, journalist Carolyn Kitch disagrees. She argues that we are obsessed with yesterday, and she says the past permeates current journalism. Today, in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, she will be talking with the host, Celeste Quinn. She's the author of a newly published book entitled Pages from the Past, History and Memory in American Magazines. That's coming up on the afternoon magazine in the 1 o'clock hour today. The show itself gets underway at noon with the usual mix of news and weather and sports. Celeste Quinn is the host for the program. Coming up in the next part of this show, we will be talking with Daniel Benjamin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and he is the co-author of a recently published book that's titled The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror and a Strategy for Getting It Right. He says quite right out in the book that he thinks we are losing the war on terror, that many mistakes have been made. He does, however, think there are things we could do to change our approach to make it work better, and we'll talk about some of those ideas with him. And of course, continue to welcome your comments in the next part of the show. Right now, though, as we usually do, we will break for news at the top of the hour, 1 minute past. Before that, an update on the commodity markets.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri-Energy in Palestine, Illinois, producing a renewable fuel with corn bought directly from the farmer. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at LincolnLandAgriEnergy.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave.